Welcome to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. For thousands of years, the sages have known that compassion is a powerful force for good. In the last two decades, compassion scholars caught up with these sages, proving that there is an ROI to building loving communities and businesses. This podcast features leaders who can teach us about the power of compassion. In today's episode, I'm speaking with Daryl Brown. Daryl is my dear friend, a diversity activist, and currently a trustee on the board of directors of Fordham University. Hi, Daryl. Welcome to the show. Now tell us, how did you go from successful student athlete to pro basketball player to executive at ABC Radio?
Sure, Laurel. I really think that all three of those stages are obviously interconnected because it's all about me. But they're interconnected in a way that my life has really been about moving forward. Moving forward in a way that gathered momentum as society moved forward. I always kind of got the impression that I was supposed to do something, and I didn't know exactly what it was. There was an evolution that had to take place inside of me over the years that brought me to this point. Often when I meditate, it's really about finding my passion and finding what I'm supposed to do in this moment. I didn't know exactly where I was headed, but I knew I had to be fully in my energy to get there. So from a high school student and athlete, I was successful, but I felt like I had to do it because back then, you know, if you were Black, to make it in America's society, which is white male dominant, I really had to be driven because I had to be at 150%, not at 100%. My 100% was not going to get me there. And those were the messages that I would get via the media and my role models at the time. Those were the messages. You know, moving on from high school, and, you know, I got a lot of scholarship offers and visited a lot of schools, but I chose Fordham University mainly because it was close to home and because they played in Madison Square Garden. I was driven by ego back then, and I really, really wanted the big stage. And I wanted people who knew me to see me on a big stage. So back then, the New York Knicks were, it was the most unbelievable team that, for me, was ever assembled. And I was a big Knicks fan, and they continually sold out Madison Square Garden. Fordham University, who played in Madison Square Garden, and was also selling out the Garden for the games that they played. So I wanted to be a part of that. Fordham had a great law school. They had a great academic reputation. So I wanted to be a part of that. So that's why I went.
Was playing basketball professionally something you always aspired to?
I never thought that I would, or my goal was never to be in the NBA. A lot of athletes' dream is to be a professional, to go into the NBA or the major leagues or play in the NFL or Major League Baseball. That's why you put so much into it. That was never my dream. It just wasn't. So I did well in college, played well. I was an academic All-American, and I got drafted by the Boston Celtics. After I was drafted, I said, I'm going to give it 2 years, and that's it. You know, and after 2 years, I'm not going to continue to chase after it. There's a process going to rookie camp, and then if you make it to rookie camp, they take 7 people out of 40, and then you practice with the Celtics team, and you are a Boston Celtic. You play exhibition games, and then every other day, 20 goes down to 19, and then it'll go down to 17, and then it'll go down to 15. You're playing games, but this two-week process of elimination, you know, it's like musical chairs, except that probably about 10 veterans already have their spot. So you're really only competing for 2 or 3 spots. And over those 2 weeks, the chairs get eliminated. It was 2 days before the regular season started, and I was let go. And it was crushing at first, that first year. Actually, the first year I knew that I wasn't good enough. Second year I went out and I worked hard on my game, and that's when I was eliminated 2 days before the season started, and it was crushing because I had worked so hard. I finally did fall into the camp of, hey, I can be an NBA player, right? I never realized it until then. So I got released 2 days before the season started, and it really was crushing because I had gotten my game together. So I went back, I played basketball over in Europe, and it was a great experience. I was in 12 different countries over 2 years, and I wound up mainly playing in Sweden, but it was fabulous. What a great experience to be in another culture and learn a different language and have to familiarize yourself with other customs of players who were used to doing things a different way than, you know, basketball was completely different over there than it was here. So after that second year of getting released, I went to a game at Fordham. The head basketball coach said, if you ever want to go to graduate school, you can get your degree and we'll pay for it. I said, I'll be here in September. I decided at that time that the flow of life was really telling me that enough with this NBA thing. You've given it the shot that you said you were going to give it. You said you were going to give it 2 years. It's not working out. Let's move on to what you really want to do. I was a broadcast major. I went back for my management degree in journalism, and then I just started knocking on doors in New York City.
Errol, I want you to tell the story of becoming an executive at ABC Radio Network and then Disney.
A Fordham alumnus told me that if I was patient, he would get me in at ABC. And I think I worked for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey for, I got a job there because I needed to make money to pay my rent. They were happy to have me. And I worked at the Port Authority bus terminal, which at that time at 41st and 8th Avenue was not the place you really wanted to be. It was not a destination that I ever envisioned myself going to. But after working there for 3 months, the Fordham alum, who was the vice president of ABC, gave me a call. He was the vice president in charge of 4,000 radio stations at the ABC radio network. And he brought me in. He gave me the title of manager of special projects, which was a euphemism for an administrative assistant. And he kind of said, do something with this. I don't know what you're going to do, but do something. So when I got there, I said, wow, there's some other radio stations that you're not programming to. And there's an audience out there that you're not reaching, and that is the black audience, right? So they weren't selling their commercials to 13% of the population. So I convinced them that they were leaving money on the table. That they understood. They didn't understand black radio, but they understood that they were leaving money on the table and that that might be a new revenue stream for them. In the advertising community, during the 60s, there were no black images. The advertising community had said early on, black people don't buy things. They don't have money, so they don't buy things. So why should we advertise to them? Which is one of the reasons why ABC did not have black programming, because they couldn't sell commercials, because if they thought it was black, they wouldn't buy it. So, you know, it's all part of the same scheme. The value of a black viewer or a black listener was less than the value of a white viewer or white listener. So when I got into ABC, I wanted to prove that the black listener, the value of reaching them is worth millions. It's worth millions. And that's exactly what happened. I did the background work and proved it inside of ABC and found a talent here in Dallas, Tom Joyner, who was advocating for black people forever. We took him national. He was on two stations, and we took him from two stations to 126 cities across the country. And it was a national phenomenon. It was wildly successful. We had 65% profit margins. It was a gold mine. It was a gold mine because we were able to increase the value of a black listener. That's really where it was.
What an amazing story. We've just got to admit that sometimes economics propels social change.
You know, our entire system and the inherent injustices are built around power and economics, right? It's really all about finances. So I don't know how I knew that, but I knew that. There was something inside of me that said, there is a theme here, and it is really corporate ignorance, number one, and fear of not making a return on their investment by investing in Black America. And there was also a lack of leadership inside of ABC. And here I am making $17,000 a year and administrative assistant saying, hey, listen, let's go this way. That's what really made them invest in the urban. They wouldn't call it black. That's what really made them invest in urban radio.
It's painful that they would be willing to spend the money, but not able to call it what it actually was, a black audience.
Just that in itself was an unnecessary slight, because when they go out to sell commercials, they would sell commercials and label it the urban audience so that they'd be able to say that urban means city. And in the city, they're white people too. It's not a black audience, it's an urban audience, which enabled them to sell it for more money. So again, let's go back to the idea that economics drives justice. And I knew that with the money that ABC had, with that kind of power, we could do some good things for the black audience. And at that time, I didn't care what you called it. I really didn't care what you called it. I just wanted to be a part of developing a platform to deliver quality audience with the backing of ABC and then later on Disney. It just was a fabulous, fabulous marriage that started in, I guess I started there in 1980, and the urban program development started in 94. And speaking the truth, we had white ABC account executives selling it. So think about that. We had white account execs going out to white advertising agency people, speaking the same language and getting a higher rate for the black consumer. But really what it came down to was white people trusting white people. It's an awful truth, right? But that is exactly what happened. Every program that we developed, and as we expanded our department, we got into Hispanic radio. It was wonderful. My level, I was an executive vice president, and underneath that came senior vice presidents, came vice presidents, came directors of programming, all with backgrounds in their respective fields. Now they had these titles inside of ABC and Disney. I mean, it was just wonderful. I was able to build a department that, you know, was made up of people who looked like me. And they saw me in a position so that they knew that they could get there too. And what a wonderful experience that was. It was just absolutely wonderful.
Do you think there is room for even more change?
Yeah, there's so much work to be done, and there's so much education that has to happen. And I'll tell you, I specifically talked about the white account exec going to the white agency because they trust each other. That phenomenon still is in place, because it's going to take white people in power listening to other white people who are willing to teach for things to change. You know, black people have tried to do this since the 60s, and it hasn't worked. You know, we haven't seen demonstrable change. So in order to see change, there has to be an educational process that goes on with white people. It's not about giving handouts to black people. You know, we've done that. All that does is keep the system the same way it is. In order for the systems to change, the educational process of white people has to evolve.
How has it been for you personally this year with these new conversations around racism? I mean, they may not be new to you, but as a white person sitting in Sag Harbor, it feels different.
Why does it feel different for you?
It's definitely different. What happened to Mr. Floyd is just a bigger part of my life. I also think for me personally, slowing down helped me to feel more pain and more outrage.
Bingo, Laurel. Bingo. I think that part of the deal now is that you're feeling, as a white woman, you're feeling more comfortable because you also see other white people demonstrating fiercely, right? It's not the demonstrations of the 60s anymore, where you had some white liberals marching with Martin Luther King. That's not what you see. There's a different type of protesting going on now. And I think that the sheltering in place really does come into play, because the sheltering in place has made everybody a little bit more reflective on how they are in the world and what their vulnerabilities really are. We have all bought into the white supremacist system that was developed back in the 1600s. It was developed to keep power, to centralize power, to keep the flow of money going the way it was in order to develop the economic system of the United States. You know, it was built on tobacco and cotton. Now they're talking about reparations for those people who kept that system going. But we all bought into it. And I think the pandemic has caused us all to take a look at the part that we play in all of these systems.
So I want to move on to Fordham University. Talk to me about the progress you've made as a board at Fordham, going from not talking about race to talking about it. I'm really curious about that.
There were six of us who were getting together to say, we've benefited greatly from our education at Fordham. What can we do as Black alumni to help the university? Really, not just the university, but to help Black youths in the metropolitan area. That's how it started. And Fordham University being a formidable piece of the Bronx and Manhattan and developing young minds, we walked into Father McShane, who was the president of the university, and said, what can we do? He said, well, you can be the Fordham gents and be mentors to the Black athletes who are going to school here because we need help. And at the time, there were some racial incidents that were happening on campus. And Father McShane, to his credit, said, I don't know what to do. I'm not Black. I've never walked in your shoes. I need help. Please help me. We had to explain to him that the problem is not with the Black athletes. The problem is with the 96% of the white students who go to school here. If you're going to change a culture, you got to start with who dominates the culture.
What a great example of compassionate leadership. Father McShane made the choice to let down his guard, admit his area of weakness, and say, I don't know, I need help.
That man is in the process of changing the culture at Fordham University, because over the last 7 years, we have gone from having a lot of racial incidents on campus to, in 2015, we had a racial diversity task force. And it was made up of faculty, alumni, administrators, and a couple of coaches, I think, were on it too, and a few students. We now have a chief diversity officer at Fordham University. We now have a vice president who's Black, human resources. The faculty at the university has, I'm not going to say turned over, but the look of the faculty has changed demonstrably. The board members, there are at least eight of us on the board now, and eight of 40 is pretty strong compared to when I started on the board and where the board was. And with diverse opinions, companies thrive and boards thrive. If we're really going to change, we have to change the culture on the board, not just the way it looks, but the culture on the board. The chairman of the board and the president had to really take a look at themselves before we move forward. And each board member had to take a look at themselves, because you're telling us that we're fellow trustees and we have a stake in this. So here's what we're telling you. Take a look at yourselves and don't expect for us to educate you. You're going to have to do some listening and go out and do some homework on your own. They were a bit shocked at that, at knowing that, oh, you know, we haven't arrived yet. And in order for this thing to change, it's going to take some training. So they committed to training at the board level, administration level, faculty level, as well as the student level. So all levels will go through a training process so that slowly but surely, and this is a marathon, you know, this is not going to happen over the next couple of years. Things will change there. Things will change. Things have changed. Things are changing, you know, and as long as you can point to a program that's in place, trainings that are in place, reflections from the dominant class that are in place, then you have a shot at changing culture.
I'm curious, as an educator, how do you find white allies willing to help and reflect about themselves and get educated?
Yeah, let's talk about the Jesuit mission and being of service. Let's talk about any religion, really. If one person is poor, we're all poor, right? If one person is troubled, we are all troubled. Father McShane ends his commencement speech to the graduating class at Fordham by saying, go out and be bothered. You should all be bothered, right? And that always, every time I say it, an emotion runs through me that I know I'm on the right path. And I personally have always been bothered. That's why I've done what I do.
For Fordham, it was going back to their core values and living them. And I think for a lot of us, we can start there, whether it's our parents that taught us how to live life, or what we learned in school, or what we learned in our religion, going back to basics in some way.
You know, Laurel, if you look at one of the top nonfiction books now, one of them is White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. I encourage all white people to read this book, mainly because it's a white person talking about her fragility around having a discussion about race. So you're so right about being courageous enough to step, not even step, to stomp on eggshells, right? Because we all have to put our fear guard down. We have to be vulnerable to listen to one another. And White Fragility really spells it out, which is why it's one of the best sellers in nonfiction.
Well, Darryl Brown, thank you for being bothered. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it. My takeaway from this is it's going to be uncomfortable, but it's so important to have these conversations.
Thank you, Laurel.
Thanks for listening to the Compassionate Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com. Please join us each week as we shine a light on compassionate leaders making a positive impact on their communities and the world.